afternoon when some young guy with burglary tools tried to climb in her window. When you told her to cover up, she said, "Well, I figured I shouldn't be touching nothing at the scene of the crime." And we'd laugh until the tears ran down our cheeks into our shrimp fra diavolo. Or you'd tell me how you shoved some punk up against the wall. A kid who'd grabbed a television set from the old Jewish man who'd said he'd never move his appliance store from the old neighborhood. And how you'd discovered the punk had enough warrants to really put him away. Not like the other times. The times when you finished your paperwork and then cruised by the projects and saw the guy you had busted just sitting out by the hydrant with a big smile on his face. And I'd look at you, with your dark skin and eyes and heavy brows and big bottom lip, the inside the color of a red grape, and think what I'd thought when Tommy Dolan introduced us at that bar down by the water my first year in nursing school, when I was 19. When Tommy said, "You gotta meet Franny Flynn, everybody likes her." I'd think that you were the best-looking man I'd ever seen. And maybe seeing that thought in my eyes, seeing yourself in my eyes, so big and strong and sure of himself, that Bobby Benedetto, always a crowd around him at the bar, listening to his stories, buying him drinks, seeing yourself like that in my eyes, you'd take my hand across the table. And you'd even listen to a few of my stories, too. Although that stopped after a while. You gradually stopped listening, and I stopped talking the last couple of years, when you were so angry all the time instead of just occasionally. When you'd been passed over for a couple of promotions and there hadn't been another baby. When you'd wrecked one car and talked your way out of a DWI, given a free ride by the two young cops at the scene after they saw your badge. 1,000 small disappointments. 6 big ones. And you'd stopped talking about the people trying to keep their sons out of trouble in the projects, the teenage girls taking good care of their babies, and started talking all the time about the spics and the jigs, the people you busted and I patched up. They live like animals, you'd say. And you'd look around our house, with the flowered couches and the flowered drapes and the flowered canisters lined up on the kitchen counter, flour, sugar, coffee, tea. You always liked things to be so neat, just like at your mother's. "The baby's got fingerprints all over this coffee table," you yelled upstairs one Sunday morning before your friends were coming over for football and lasagna. "You know where to find the Windex," I yelled back. What possessed me? What possessed me after the guys were gone to say, "When Jackie Farron chews, you can hear him in the next room"? "Jackie's a good man," you said. "He still eats like a pig." "Yeah, God forbid anyone should offend your ears, huh, Fran? Plus he scratches himself sometimes, right? That's it. Let's take him off the guest list. Jackie Farron's got God knows how many goddamn decorations for bravery, but he scratches his balls and chews with his mouth open." "I'm going to bed," I'd said. "I'll do the dishes in the morning." "We'll have roaches all over the goddamn kitchen, and with the new carpeting, we got no money left over for an exterminator." And on and on and on about nothing, until finally he shoved me into the kitchen table so hard I fell and cracked my collarbone. "Jesus Christ, Fran, I was just a little lit," he said the next day. But it was past the time when he would take me in his arms to say it. The Bobby he saw in my eyes now was no hero. My eyes had become a funhouse mirror that reflected back a grotesque. For 2 weeks he laid off the beer and came home early from work. He even took Robert out a couple of times by himself. "The boys'll go to the park and give Mom a rest," he said. Things were good there for almost a year. It was my first broken bone. I think maybe that scared him. but I knew he'd try again and again and yet again to wipe that look off my face, that reflection of himself in my eyes. Women who have had this happen need to understand that domestic violence has nothing to do with them, with what they did or didn't do. Patty Bancroft had told the hospital auditorium full of doctors and nurses, advising them on how to treat their patients, how to get them help. It was like listening to an oncologist give a case history when you were rotten with cancer. I spent so many nights listening to the sound of Bobby's breathing in the dark and trying to figure out what had happened, whether it was his mother or his father, Robert's birth, or envy over the big collar some other guy had made, or the booze, or the raise I got that meant I was making $900 more than he was every year, 900 lousy dollars they could have back at the hospital for all I cared. "Hey, Frances Ann," he said, doing our taxes at the desk in the little den overlooking the alley behind the house, "you make more money than I do." And a shiver went all through me. I could read his voice as well as I could read an X-ray. I think that was the night I realized I could never merely divorce or leave him the way other women could leave their husbands. Knew he would never let me go. I was packing Robert's school lunch, making a peanut butter sandwich with no jelly, quartering an apple, and he was sitting at the kitchen table drinking a beer.
"What, the kid can't eat an apple like everyone else?"
he said, watching me. "He likes it cut up."
"You baby him."
That's what Bobby always said about Robert.
"You baby him."
The phone rang, I remember, and he sighed because he thought it was someone from work, and it was, but mine, not his. "Hey, nurse," Ben Samuels had said. That's how he always greeted me at the hospital. "Hey, nurse. Hey, doctor." He was a good doctor. He always touched the patients when he talked to them. He always looked into their eyes. "Hi," I said, looking at Bobby. "Remember that book on spiritual healing we talked about a couple of weeks ago?" Ben Samuels said. "There's a documentary about it on PBS tonight, in about half an hour. I thought you'd like to take a look at it." "Thanks," I said. "See you tomorrow." I could tell by the silence that he was puzzled by my brusqueness. I had my back to Bobby as I hung the phone up. Every phone call was like espionage by that time. "That was Winnie," I said, "about some documentary on spiritual healing on TV at 10.
"What the hell is spiritual healing?"
"The idea that the power of the mind can overcome illness as effectively as medical treatment. We've been talking about it at the hospital."
"Sounds like bullshit to me," Bobby said.
He went to the refrigerator, opened another beer, rubbed against me as he went back to the table and sat back down, lifted his beer in the Bobby Benedetto patented lift, drank deep. His sweat smelled like beer at night, his sweat and his breath. He looked up at me.
"Who did you say that was?"
he said. "Winnie."
"It didn't sound like Winnie from where I was sitting."
At 10, I turned on the television and sat down on the couch. Bobby dropped into his lounge chair.
"Give me the remote, Fran," he said.
He had another beer in his hand. 2 minutes of narration and he shook his head. "Can the human mind control the human body?" said a voice. And Bobby switched to the sports channel. Ah, what a rare pair we were. "I'm going to bed," I said.
"You didn't really want to watch that shit, did you?"
he called after me. "Actually, I did."
"Bring me another beer, all right, Frances?"
I carried another bottle of Bud into the living room, leaving fingerprints on the icy bottle.
You couldn't open it?
For God's sake, Bobby, it's a twist-off cap. Even if it wasn't, you could probably get it off without an opener.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
I'd carried the empty back into the kitchen and didn't answer. When I turned from the trash, he was standing in the doorway. He looked good when he was drunk. I'd noticed it when he was younger. His eyes glittered and his mouth went slack in a way that had once made me warm and willing and now made me very, very careful. Most of the time.
"Who'd you say that was on the phone?"
he asked.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, Bob," I began. "Oh, for Christ's sake, what, Fran?"
he said in that low, slow voice, his eyelids at half-mast. He put down the bottle and moved in on me, and I didn't know which was worse. My first thought, that he was going to make me do it in the kitchen, pressed back against the edge of the white formica countertop, or my second, that he wasn't going to be able to do it himself. I could feel that he couldn't. Could feel him feeling it.
"You need to put a little weight on Fran," he'd said, pushing against me. "You're nothing but skin and bones."
He kissed me hard, more holding my mouth down with his face than a kiss. I couldn't breathe, and I tried to slide my face away from his, but he had a hand at the back of my neck, and finally I had to push him. Had to. I was suffocated, smothered, fighting for air. He tried to push his mouth back down on mine, although I was gasping, and I slid sideways and he fell forward, bumping his chin into the cabinet door. It was like one motion, the fingers lifted to his own face, the backhand to mine, so that I fell and cut my head on the pointed corner of the cabinet by the window, felt the blood warm in my hair and on my neck. When I'd imagined marriage, when I was standing at the altar of St. Stanny's the week after I'd turned 21, I'd never imagined staring at the ceiling, the back of my hair matted with blood, willing my husband to get done and get off. We'd written our own vows. "I will follow you," Bobby said, his voice making it sound as though it was in bold italics, "to the ends of the earth." And he would. I knew it as he snored beside me that night, he smelling of Budweiser, me of blood. That night I got pregnant again, but I lost the baby after 4 months. And for a week he gave me a massage every night, working the muscles in my shoulders with his strong hands straddling my body. Maybe it's hard to understand for a woman who has never had it happen to her, never watched her husband sob in contrition with those choking sobs that sound like he's swallowing glass. He made me feel cared for, Bobby did, at times like that. Cared for the way no one had ever cared for me. Babied the way I'd never been babied, even by my own parents. He reached me somehow, reeled me back in, rolled me over, and said, "I love you so much, sweetheart," and touched me so softly all over that I reached for him, although the doctor said to wait, and got pregnant again. And lost that one, too. For the best. For the best. When we were dating, I thought it would stop when we were married. When we were married, I thought a baby would help. After the baby, I thought if we had another child, he'd feel better. And when Robert was 2, I couldn't leave because those were the formative years, although maybe I didn't think enough about what we were forming, Bobby and I. And when Robert was starting school, I couldn't leave because school was a big adjustment. And I couldn't leave in May because I'd screw up our family summer vacation, and I couldn't leave in November because it would screw up the holidays. So I stayed,
and stayed and stayed. And then those three women were killed. And when I read their stories, I realized that all of them had left. The way everyone expects you to when he hits you, beats you up. They filed the papers, got the restraining orders, said no more. But two had been enticed back, over and over again. And one had never managed to get away even after the divorce. Her husband had kicked in the apartment door, showed up at her office, grabbed her at the bus stop in front of a dozen witnesses who watched him lay into her, then finally killed her. All dead, all three of them, even though they left, even though they tried to break away. They were the ones who wound up broken. And I could hear Bobby's voice begging, begging, breaking me down. And I could see him following me on my morning run, sitting three seats away on the bus to the hospital, talking Robert into letting him into the house. That's when I realized that I wasn't going to be able to leave the way other women left their husbands. I wasn't going to be able to leave at all. I was going to have to disappear. I looked around the apartment as Patty Bancroft talked. Maybe, then, this was the ends of the earth. But at least it had curtains. "They'll give you uniforms," Patty Bancroft said about my new job after she'd fed more quarters into the phone. "Do they know?" I said.
"What?"
"Do they know who I am?"
"They know you're Elizabeth Crenshaw," said Patty Bancroft. "You have excellent references. There's no licensing requirement in Florida. It's one reason you're there. They'll send you out on a case or two next week."
"Beth," I said. "I've decided on Beth."
"Everything will be fine, Beth," she said, "if you do what we say."
"You sound like my husband."
"Excuse me?"
"You sound like my husband. Everything will be fine if you do what I say." There was a silence in which I could hear people talking and laughing, walking through what must have been an airport on their way to somewhere else. Traveling, not fleeing. "Make no mistake about it," Patty Bancroft said. "He is looking for you right now." Scut work was what the agency gave me. Work for an orderly, not a nurse. Cooking, cleaning, shopping. But it was fine. It was wonderful. Places to go, people to see. My first visit was to a 30-year-old woman with cerebral palsy in a blank-faced apartment complex for the handicapped. Her name was Jennifer. And she told me what she needed by tapping on the keyboard of a computer with a long, straight stick harnessed to her quivering hand. She looked like a bird, her head rising and falling as though she was eating instead of just telling me what she wanted to eat, her eyes rolling above a slack mouth that appeared to smile. "Instant oatmeal," she wrote my first day, "quart skim milk, Jell-O pudding cups, chocolate, TY. TY for thank you." She said it, too, although it sounded more like a growl or a throat clearing than a word. When I came back with the groceries, I could hear the printer attached to her computer humming. After I'd changed the sheets on the single bed in the tiny back room, she used the stick to point to a stack of papers in the printer tray. 11 pages of painstaking notes, including dates of all her hospitalizations. The first sentence was, "My name is Jennifer Ann March, and I was born in Atlanta, Georgia at 6:14 a.m. on Tuesday, November 7th, 1967. The attending obstetrician was not available, and an obstetrical resident, Dr. Gregory Little, performed the delivery with high forceps. The forceps, I said aloud, not really meaning to. And she made the growling noise again and bobbed her head as if to say, yes, yes, that's why I am the way you see me today, because of damage done by the forceps and the resident. If not for those high forceps, I would be a 30-year-old woman playing tennis at the public courts and working evenings as a waitress at Daisy's on the highway. Or maybe, given the intelligence and diligence of the medical history I held in my hands, a 30-year-old woman finishing her doctoral dissertation on single-celled organisms or 19th-century chamber music. Everyone needs a way of making sense of their deformities, and a difficult birth was as good a way as any of explaining CP, of explaining to herself why she was slumped sideways, imprisoned in her own body, proffering these single-spaced pages as a way to make me see her as human. Is this for me? I asked, and her head bobbed again. On her computer screen, words appeared like magic, messages from people jousting with one another verbally in a chat room. The meteor showers this weekend were stupendous, said the last line on the screen. From Manitoba, they looked like silver fireworks. I'm going now, I said. I'll be back Tuesday. Can I bring anything with me? Her wobbly head swayed from side to side. Her hair was cut short, perhaps an inch long all over. I knew a nurse dressed her in the mornings. Count your blessings, my father always said. It shames you to count yours by the hardships of other people. That noise again, deep in her throat. You're welcome, I said, closing the door behind me, stepping outside into the heat. Maybe Patty Bancroft was right. Maybe Bobby was looking for me even as I put pudding and milk into Jennifer's refrigerator. But I was looking for him right back. I walked to my jobs by a different route each time, peering into parked cars, turning around if someone came up slowly behind me. Cindy and I volunteered in the school library for the first hour of every day. She could tell Chelsea she was in the building, and I could keep an eye on Robert and on the door to the school, just opposite the library double doors. We traded in sweating in the parking lot for reshelving and covering books under the querulous direction of old Mrs. Petrinian, who called each of us Mommy. The school secretary got to know me, to expect to see me around. If Robert has any problem, you'll call, I asked one day when I brought her an iced tea from the cafeteria. Absolutely, she said, tapping an envelope of Sweet and Low into her cup with a long nail painted pink and white. Most days Cindy and I had coffee after, unless Chad had Gymboree. All first-time moms who talk about the baby falling off the bed like it's the Titanic, she said dismissively. If I hear one more debate about putting tubes in for ear infections, I will spit. Then we went to work. Cindy loaded her black imitation leather display cases into the minivan, and I went to see my patients. There was Jennifer twice a week, and a dialysis patient from the local hospital named Melvin, whose skin was as yellow as margarine. He never even looked away from the television as I took his blood pressure and listened to his heart. He watched the stock ticker on the financial network and made notes on a legal pad. He's not taking this well, said his wife. He was a long-distance trucker waiting for a kidney transplant. In the meantime, he played the stock market on paper, buying and selling in his head. GM, Textron, IBM, The Gap. Every morning he sent his wife to the 7-Eleven for lottery tickets. You think it's wrong to pray for a transplant, said his wife, whose name was Ada. Why would you think it was wrong to pray for a transplant? I offered to give him one myself, but the doctor said it was no good. Otherwise, someone has to die. I mean, someone has to die for him to get a kidney. It seems like a hard thing, to pray for someone to die. Don't worry about that, Ada, I said. I saw Melvin twice a week, too. I couldn't warm to him, although I felt sorry for Ada, who washed his sheets every day in Clorox to get out the sweat stains. But my main job, and my favorite one, was taking care of the Levitts in a building called the Lakeview on the other side of the highway from our house. It was a good long walk, about 20 minutes, the twin towers of the senior citizens complex rising before me like a mirage amid a sea of small white stucco houses with red tile roofs, vibrating with window air conditioners. Some days I would sit down on the steps of one small house or another, scraggly flowered bushes shielding me from view, and wipe my forehead with a Kleenex. Sometimes I stopped at the 7-Eleven myself for a big gulp. "Hot out there," the Asian man behind the counter always said, making it sound like one big polysyllabic word, an idiomatic expression he proffered along with a big grin as the price of doing business in this crazy, crazy country. It seemed possible that I was the only person in Lake Plata who didn't travel in an air-conditioned car. Since we'd arrived in Florida, my face had been crimson most of the time, all the blood visible through my thin skin, my hair in spikes every which way. The first day I went to the Levitts had been a school holiday, Faculty Development Day, and I'd reluctantly entrusted Robert to the Castro family, slowly, loudly, asking Milagro Castro if she could look out for him while I was gone. "Let me tell her," Benny had said, turning to his mother. A birdsong of Spanish from the boy, then a series of manic nods from his mother, then more Spanish and another emphatic nod. "She says she will take care of him the way she takes care of the rest of us. She says he is a good boy." Mrs. Castro poured forth a torrent of words, her head and hands dancing. "She says Robert will have lunch with us, and it will be a pleasure to have him. She says he is a good boy, and she will not let him out of her sight." "All right, Ma, that's enough," Benny had turned back to me. "She's saying a lot of praying stuff. Well, not praying exactly, but God stuff. That's okay, Mommy. She understands." And the two boys had trudged into the Castro apartment, arguing about which comic superhero was more indestructible, as Benny's mother and I bowed and grinned like dolls on the back of a car dash. Women's work, they seemed to say with their retreating backs. The screen slammed. Then Robert came back out, pulled me aside as Mrs. Castro smiled upon us both, and whispered, "When are you coming back?" "Around 4, I said.
4 in the afternoon?"
"Are you sure you don't want to come with me? I said you could come with me and sit in the lobby." He shook his head. "I just want to know." He turned back to Benny, and I turned toward the Lakeview and the Levitts. "Look, Irfink," Mrs. Levitt said the first time she opened her apartment door to me, as I stood outside in a hallway that smelled like Lysol and old people. "Look," she said, after standing on tiptoe and peering through the peephole. "They sent a new one." The Levitts lived in a one-bedroom apartment with a kitchen so small that Mrs. Levitt and I could not make iced tea and sandwiches in it at the same time. It had one of those balconies so many apartment buildings in New York had, just big enough to stand on, small, ugly, and useless, the appendix of modern architecture. Mrs. Levitt used it only to check for a storm coming when she heard the warning on the weather channel, and to hang her hand washables. Sometimes, as I got close to the building, I could tell which apartment was the Levitt's by the assortment of corsetry baking in the still air. The apartment was as plain and simple as the inside of a box, but it was full of rococo furniture, sideboard next to highboy, a big sectional with old brocade pillows worn soft as baby skin, an assortment of sepia photographs displayed in lucite frames on a bureau pushed into one corner. There were dining room chairs, but no dining table, end tables with geometric inlay and flimsy plastic tray tables. The oriental rug was tucked under at one end, 6 inches too long for its surroundings. One corner of the living room was crammed with a hospital bed, a card table with medications and spray cleaners and adult diapers, and a large oil painting of a dark forest in an elaborate gilt frame. When I was a student nurse, I'd done home visits to a 70-year-old cancer patient, a retired furrier whose small efficiency had been much the same. Their lives shrink as they get older, but their furniture stays the same size, my clinical supervisor had said. That color washes you out, Mrs. Levitt said the first day I went there, as she opened the door and looked at the blue polyester zip front shift that I wore on the job, which fomented and held perspiration like the plastic weight loss wraps I'd seen in women's magazines. And hello to you, too, I said. Uh-oh, Irving, Mrs. Levitt said. This one's got a funny bone. There wasn't much for me to do with the Levitts, really. He had had a stroke that left him incontinent, mute, and largely paralyzed except for the occasional wild spasm. Together we changed Irving's sheets and his pajamas. Mostly we drank tea after feeding Irving pureed peas and broth through a straw and changing his diapers. Can I use the phone to call my son? I said that first day. It's a local call. Mom, I'm fine, Robert said, impatient. We were in the middle of something. I'll be home soon, I said, hearing in his voice, in his breathing, impatient little snorts that he didn't care, that part of his great slow sinking into normalcy was to go about the business of being a boy with everything that was in him. I'll be honest, sweetheart, Mrs. Levitt said in her accented English. I can sure use the help with Irving here, but it's also a pleasure to have someone to talk to. Not that Irving's not someone, but you were never a wonderful conversationalist even before, were you, Irving? She winked at me, lifted a hand to her woolly hair, stippled white and gray, which looked as though it had been permed and then left to get by as best it could for the duration. Florida. Florida, he says, as soon as he starts thinking about retiring. Everybody's going to Florida. What am I going to do in Florida, Irving, I say. But next day we woke up and there was a foot of snow. Oh, boy, I said to myself, that's that. Next thing I know, he's got the house on the market. She heaved herself out of a mahogany chair, using the beautifully carved and curving arms for leverage, and motioned me over to a broom closet in the hallway between living room and bedroom. Inside there was a vacuum cleaner, a quilted gold garment bag that smelled of mothballs, and a set of golf clubs. You golf? Mrs. Levitt said. I shook my head. Lots of cops golf, a slightly more athletic variation on the theme of sitting together out on the patio talking about how the transit cops are morons and the patrol cars all need new shocks. Bobby lifted weights instead. His forearms felt like a boneless rib roast before defrosting. God, he had a beautiful body. You got nothing to complain about, Fran, one of the cop wives had said to me once at a PBA clam bake in Hampton Bays, looking from Bobby to her husband. Baby likes beer, her husband used to say, patting his belly. Mrs. Levitt gave the golf clubs a kick with her bedroom scuff. He says he's going to take up golf. 71 years old, and he thinks he's, what was his name, Arthur somebody, big golfer. Weren't you, Irving? All that handicap nonsense you picked up from Bernie Meerson and his gang at the swim club. Do you think I should put an ad in the paper, try and sell them? The golf clubs? Mrs. Levitt nodded, went back to her chair, the tea and cookies. She leaned toward me and lowered her voice. What would happen is this, she said, squinting at me. Somebody'd buy the clubs. Irving would wake up or come out of this. She waved her hand toward the corner as though to indicate the whole mess, the adjustable back of the bed, the box of diapers, the catheter bags. And he would say, Selma, where the hell are my clubs? You sold them? What, Selma, you thought I was going to die? She shrugged, her pillowy torso rising and falling with certainty and resignation. I looked over at Irving. A yellow mummy with rheumy dark eyes, his fingers twitching, his breathing the closest he came to conversation. The bed was angled so he had a panoramic view of the cluttered, random landscape of Lake Plata, one small roof after another broken only by the skeleton supports of the water tower and the boxy sprawl of the Walmart and Kmart. But he seemed to see nothing, hear nothing. Perhaps he could still feel the drumbeat of his heart beating in his body. Who could tell? It was hard to imagine him demanding his nine iron.
"Never mind," Mrs. Levitt said. "What do you think about this girl went missing in Orlando? The boyfriend killed her, you take my word for it."
Oh, I believed that.
Listening to Mrs. Levitt talk about Irving was like sitting out back at a barbecue talking to the other cop wives, the way I'd done dozens of times during my marriage. Sometimes on those summer afternoons, I'd think Bobby was right, that I exaggerated things. I'd sit in the backyard of Bobby's friend Buddy's split level out on Long Island and listen to Buddy's wife Marie and her sister Terry, who was also married to a cop, and Marie's neighbor Anne Marie, whose husband was a firefighter, and they all made it sound like marriage was the stations of the cross, like that was the natural order, trial by husband. He can sit out there like Father of the Year, but God forbid he should bathe one of them or buy them a pair of shoes, said Marie.
A pair of shoes, said Terry. What, are you dreaming? A pair of shoes? What about putting the goddamn mayonnaise away after he makes a sandwich?
He makes his own sandwich, said Anne Marie, and we had to laugh.
Had to. Oh, Lord, the stories they told. And all of them funny and sharp, like Mrs. Levitt's. About how Terry was so tired from the kids one night that she fell asleep in the middle of sex. About how Buddy showed up at one of the girls' birthdays drunk and passed out on the couch, where the party carried on without him, around him. How someone put a buttercream rosebud on his nose and he never even stirred. About Anne Marie's husband, Kevin, and the toast he gave at his brother's wedding that was so full of profanity and references to the groom's previous girlfriends that the bride burst into tears.
Honest to God, it's like having five kids, and the girls are easier, Marie said. The working girl, they all called me. Hey, Fran, they'd say, what's up in the real world? And I'd tell stories about the hospital. About the girl who came into the ER 10 centimeters dilated and named her baby Benedetto because she kept staring at my name tag, yelling and cursing and using her long toes against the laminated footboard of the bed for leverage while she pushed. About the gunshot victim who tried to grab the bullet as a resident held it high on the blade of his retractors and raised a ruckus when we wouldn't let him have it for his collection. I got 5 of these suckers on the headboard of my bed, man, he moaned. 5, all lined up nice. Give me that one. About the couple who came in hemming and hawing and finally managed to say that somehow the condom got lost. A female resident put on rubber gloves and retrieved it.
You're supposed to unroll it as you put it on, she said to the guy.
Damn, he said.
We'd sit in the kitchen, and I'd tell those stories, and they'd howl, those women. Never the men. The men sat on the patio under the awning in the summer, and downstairs in the finished basement during the football season. They got the big screen TV. We got the kitchen table and the fridge. I don't think I exchanged more than 5 words, fine thanks and take it easy, with Buddy in all the time I knew him. We were barely inside the door, Bobby and me, before he'd go in one direction and I in the other, to the kitchen with the women. It was like we were different species. None of the women worked. None of their husbands wanted them to work, they said. They all said it as if they were a little curious, like they wondered how come Bobby let me, like they'd discussed it among themselves, like they were waiting for me to let them in on the secret. None of them knew that there were ways in which Bobby made me pay for the luxury of working my butt off at South Bay 5, sometimes 6 days a week.
I got enough to do around here, said Marie. I remember wondering whether that was it, whether if I stayed home and made silk flower wreaths and decoupage boxes, Bobby wouldn't be so mad at me all the time. Except that it didn't seem that Bobby was mad at me exactly, just that he was mad, and I was the one who happened to be there.
Anne Marie went home early one evening before the rum cake and the coffee, and Marie leaned toward us and said,
That poor girl, I tell you, he's had someone on the side for 2 years now. She thinks his family is still pissed about that toast at the wedding, but they can't look her in the face because he knocked the girlfriend up.
Get out, said Terry.
Swear to God, said Marie.
Why doesn't she leave? I said.
Where would she go? Said Terry. She should screw up her whole life because her husband is a pig. She just repainted the whole house. She papered the hallway.
I told them about Patty Bancroft, too, when she came to the hospital. They'd already seen her on television, talking about how a woman could get lost in the great expanse of America with a little help from the right people. We're better than the Witness Protection Program, she said on one afternoon talk show. All Buddy would have to do would be to raise a hand to me once, and I'd knock him on his ass, Marie said.
You don't know, said Terry.
And I looked at her. Looked at her brown eyes with their thick fringe of mascara like spiders around them. She didn't look back at me, and I wondered. But wondering was all any of us would ever do. We'd put on silky cocktail dresses and blow dry our hair and walk into the weddings and christenings and confirmations, our husbands checking the coats, slipping the tickets into the pockets of their suit jackets. And we'd look like happy couples, and some of us maybe were, and lots of us likely weren't. But none of us would ever talk about it. I'd been stupid when I got married. Figured it was just like an extended dating relationship, one dinner and movie after another, sex in a real bed or even on the kitchen floor. I should have known by the way the photographer made us behave for the wedding pictures. Now look at the ring, look up at him, hold up the flowers. That a lot of it would be putting up a good front, day after day, week after week, until, if we were lucky, if there wasn't cancer or a car wreck, our grandkids would someday toss us a 50th anniversary party in a catering hall and toast us, their eyes wet, for the simple fact of our stubborn marital longevity, confusing it with love. And yet, at Robert's first communion party, Bobby and I sat side by side at the table as our son thanked everyone for coming. Solemn at age 8 in his little navy blue suit and his first tie, red and blue striped, and my right hand found Bobby's left, and I looked at him and saw the father of my son, the beginning of my grown-up life, the person who slept every night on the right side of my double bed, whose shorts I'd folded in a plastic basket for 15 years. It was like there were two Bobbies, two Frans, two couples. And one was sitting at that table, knee nudging knee, breathless with love for our child, and so, by some process of osmosis, for each other. The other Bobby and Fran stayed home, waiting for nightfall. She afraid of saying the wrong thing. He, well, I never knew what he felt. Sometimes when I went to Cindy's house, I looked at the pictures of her and her husband, Craig, and wondered whether there were two of them, too. The daytime and the nighttime couple, like masks of comedy and tragedy. And Mrs. Levitt and Irving. And strangers I saw in cars, sitting next to each other at stoplights, looking straight out the windshield, never at each other, living parallel lives.
That princess and prince now? Mrs. Levitt said. There's a marriage that spelled trouble from the very beginning, and now, all of a sudden, here's the girlfriend and who knows what else.
Remember how wrinkled her wedding dress was when she got out of the coach?
The princess?
Mrs. Levitt raised her hands to the sky in mute entreaty to some greater power.
I said to my friend Flo in Chicago, I said, Flo, you sit on silk and look what happens.
If Irving hadn't had his stroke only 3 weeks after they'd moved into the Lakeview, if she'd had time to make friends with the other women in the building, Mrs. Levitt would have gossiped about the super and the single woman on the ground floor, the dry cleaner and his nasty wife. Instead, she talked about the people in the papers, the princess and her divorce, Streisand and Sinatra.
Not a happy woman, Mrs. Levitt said about one. And not a happy man, about the other.
The president and the first lady. Mrs. Levitt got the tabloids when Mrs. Winkleman down the hall left them with her recycled newspapers. She would listen on Tuesday evenings for the sound of the Winkleman door and then sneak down to the incinerator and ease the Star and the Inquirer out from the twine bundle.
Look, Irving, here's that one you liked from Dallas. Mrs. Levitt would call across the room. She's not holding up too good.
Irving, she would say, as she smoothed the blankets.
You remember how you lost all our vacation money in Vegas on half an hour at the blackjack? You think I didn't see you that time with Mamie in the vet bar of their place? She said, as his mouth gaped. You were always cheap, Irving. She mused as she went into the drawer and took out fresh pajamas, laundered so often they were soft as silk. 12 years it took me to get a decent stove, and even then I had to hear about it for the next 12. Sometimes Mr. Levitt made a sound like a groan or a wheeze, and she would say, yes, yes, yes. And something in the way she said it made me believe she had been saying it for years, that she had said it when her husband said, look at how fast that crazy man in the Chevy is driving, or it's going to pour any minute, or this is one tough piece of meat. That Mrs. Levitt had replied, yes, 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 just as she did today. I hate to say it, but the two of us ignored Mr. Levitt, paid him less mind than the television set or the coffee maker. But I had the feeling Mrs. Levitt had been doing that for quite a while.
You listening, Fran, or am I talking to myself?
Bobby would say sometimes late at night.
God, how I wanted to say, you're talking to yourself, Bobby.
But I wouldn't have dared.
He was a good worker, Mrs. Levitt said, as I irrigated and then reconnected Irving's catheter, both of us looking dispassionately at her husband's slack penis. He made a good living. Sales. He sold automobile parts. I never even learned to drive.
Too busy to teach me, right, Irving?
She smiled. Something like that, she said.
You want tuna and toast for lunch?
You don't have to go to any trouble for me, I said.
It's no trouble. I made lunch for the last girl, and she was colored. Not that I minded, but I think Irving wasn't so happy about it.
She opened the refrigerator and took out a loaf of wheat bread.
Were you, Irving?
She called into the other room and put the bread in the toaster.
But I have to say, she wasn't rude. We had one before her. She handled Irving like a sack of potatoes. I called the agency. I said she had to go. I think they sent me the colored girl for spite. Not that we minded, right, Irving?
Do you need anything? I said as I was leaving each day, and Mrs. Levitt said no until I'd been there 2 weeks. I suppose by then she'd decided she could trust me. She put her head to one side, a girlish gesture,
put one finger beneath her chin. Then she reached for her purse, a black tote bag with big white polka dots. "I'll give you the money. You'll bring People magazine," she said.
"I'll get it," I said. "Don't worry about the money."
"And some other time you'll bring me a Big Mac," she said. "Big Mac is Irving's favorite fast food. Big Mac and senior coffee. A large coffee, and only a quarter if you're over 65, which we are, right, Irving?"
She straightened his covers, tucked him in as though he was a child.
"No children," Mrs. Levitt had told me, making a vague motion toward her midsection and moving on to some movie star's marriage. "Just her and Irving, 48 years and counting." The supermarket on the strip up the street from our apartment was as big as a football field, so brightly lit that it bleached out the skin of even the tannest women pushing their kids around the aisles in carts. Jets of water sprayed the peppers and plums, so they seemed irresistible, more like art objects than produce. In one corner was a pharmacy, in another a bank, in a third a bakery section that gave off the smell of cinnamon unexpectedly as you came upon it, like one of those perfume inserts in a magazine. It was as though they'd put an entire American small town in an airplane hangar and then arranged it and lit it to best advantage. It made me think of how I'd imagined heaven when I was a kid, white light and something for everybody. People were always hollering to their kids to find a second cart, as though they had been seduced into soup and cheese and instant pudding without meaning to be. Robert and I could only buy as much as we could carry, but for the two of us that was usually plenty, and I was careful about how I spent my money. We'd been in the apartment for almost 3 months, and I still hadn't paid any rent, didn't even know how much it was. It was another one of Patty Bancroft's mysteries. "We'll take care of that end of things," she'd said, when I asked how long the rent would be taken care of. So I opened a credit union account with the home care company, putting away some money every week just in case. I wore my uniform and my hand-me-downs. Mainly I spent money on treats for Robert, trips to the arcades with Benny, weekend fast-food lunches, sometimes a shirt or a comic book. I didn't want him to feel deprived, to feel poor as well as rootless. Twice he'd had nightmares, and I'd sat with him until he fell back suddenly into sleep. He couldn't, or wouldn't, say much about the dreams. Just that there were bad guys, that he was running, that there was darkness, falling, fear. Twice he'd asked to stay home from school with a stomach ache. Once, beneath his bed, I found a piece of loose-leaf paper. "Dear Dad," in his scratchy, back-slanting penmanship, "I bet you are very surprised to..." Then nothing. Perhaps I'd told him dinner was ready, knocked at his door. Perhaps he'd heard Benny calling from downstairs. I threw the paper away. "You hungry?" I said as I found a cart whose wheels worked. Robert shrugged. He shrugged a lot, too, these days. "Are you tired?" Shrug. "Do you want to watch a movie?" Shrug. How could he care about anything at all, when in an instant it might disappear, when the outlines of our life were as faint and transparent as the picture on the old television in the living room? It was like that etch-a-sketch he'd gotten from Santa year before last. You drew the picture and then turned the toy over, and the image was gone, nothing but gray, waiting for the next one just as fleeting. I didn't know how much I'd be able to buy him for Christmas this year, or how in hell I'd ever get through it. Get through the tree and the meal and the goddamn carols. I pushed the cart and stopped thinking. I'd gotten good at that, at just cutting thoughts off as though I was changing channels, from Christmas to chicken cacciatore. The one thing I wouldn't scrimp on was food. Once the heat began to wane a bit in what, up north, passed for the beginning of winter, once I began to feel the least bit at home in the windowless kitchen in the apartment, I'd begun to cook the Italian food that Anne Benedetto had taught me to make years before. I figured it would make Robert feel more at home. the way it had made me feel as if I was making one, really making one, all those years ago.
"My mother needs a daughter," Bobby had said, "and you need to learn to cook a decent meal."
Every Sunday he dropped me off, when we were first married, at his mother's house. In his mother's kitchen, so clean that a spot of red sauce looked like blood. I took a shower before I went, did my makeup. But sometimes I thought she could smell it on me, what we'd been doing before, while Anne was at 9 o'clock Mass. Her cooking was a list of don'ts. Don't buy cheap cheese. Don't put the sauce on too high. Don't use garlic salt instead of real garlic. Don't layer the lasagna more than 3 times, no matter how deep the pan. A list of don'ts. A list of Bobby doesn'ts. Bobby doesn't like the hot sausage. Bobby doesn't like the thin spaghetti. Bobby doesn't like the bread from Emilio's bakery, only from Marie's. Most Sundays she had a new shirt for him, a soft, fine double knit with a collar, in a dark color. "I was at the outlets," she always said. Later she bought things for Robert, polo shirts and Oxford button-downs. Rags, she called T-shirts and blue jeans. Garbage, she called frozen food. "She came from nothing," Bobby's grandmother hissed when Anne went to the bathroom. "You just remember that. Don't take any crap from her. She's half Polish, for Christ's sake. My son, God love him, she gave him such a time." Bobby's grandmother always liked me, until the day she died. She gave me her cameos, that I'd had to leave behind in the rosewood jewelry box on my bureau. God, I'd thought to myself, Bobby'll really kill me if I take Mama's brooches. Mama, we always called his grandmother. Anne, I called my mother-in-law. She never asked me to call her anything else.
But she made me a cook, and so I could make Robert meatballs and bracciola, pasta fagioli and lasagna, little pieces of home at this flimsy table 2,000 miles away.
He invited Benny for dinner, and the two of them hunched over their plates without speaking until finally their mouths were shiny with tomato sauce and grease. Benny's mother did the same for Robert, beans and rice, chicken with a sauce of tomatoes and onions. Bless our boys, talking with their mouths full. "You want chicken cacciatore?" I said as Robert and I traipsed down the endless meat aisles in the supermarket. And he nodded, bent over another video game, which he'd traded his old one for to some boy at school. This one was soldiers and kickboxing. It made little grunting noises when one man hit another with his booted foot. We went past pork and beef to poultry. At the front of the store, a bulletin board held flyers with pictures of missing children. The faces changed twice a month. I knew because I always looked at them while I was pretending to get a cart with wheels that really worked. All the kids looked happy in the pictures, as though they didn't care that they were missing. "Don't put mushrooms in it," Robert said. "You don't have to eat the mushrooms." "Can I go look at the comics?" he said without raising his head from his game. "Where?" "I don't know. They're over there. I'll find them." "I'd rather you stayed with me." "Mom, I'm not a baby." "I'm all right. Just let me go." "You come back to me in 10 minutes, I said as he trotted away. I still hated to let him out of my sight. Each afternoon when I heard the school bus pull up, I stood behind the screen, a peeping Tom of a parent, making sure he got off the bus and in the house safe and sound. Sometimes I wanted to hold Benny and say thank you, over and over again. Thank you for being an ordinary boy, for making my boy seem ordinary too, for going everywhere he goes. "Where's your father?" I heard Benny ask Robert one day, but nicely, softly. There had been a long silence from the bedroom, or maybe it just seemed long because I was holding my breath. Then Robert's voice came, low. "He and my mom are split up." "Jonathan's mom and dad split up last year," Benny said. "Allison lives with her mom. I don't know where her father is. Sean, too. His parents got divorced when he was real little.
He stays with his dad every weekend in East Preston. It was as though he would go on and on with his litany of fractured families, of kids walking on the broken glass of their parents' lives. "Your mom cooks good," Benny had said after a moment. "I know," said Robert. "She cooks really good at Christmas." I held the back of my hand against my mouth, and a little saliva ran over my fingers with my tears. Everything we'd lost, everything I'd forced him to leave, seemed somehow to be in that simple sentence. "She cooks really good at Christmas." In that moment, I thought of going back, of walking in through that familiar door just so I could see the look on Robert's face. All my life, I'd tried to make my boy happy, and now, to keep him safe, I had to make him sad. And angry, too. I could see that in the set of his mouth sometimes. I'm not sure he knew who he was angry at. One night, doing his homework, he'd thrown his math book onto the floor and hit the wall with his pencil, and I'd stood up from the couch, but stopped so still, because the jerky choreography of violence and rage was so familiar to me that I couldn't come any closer, even when the object was long division. "This is so stupid," he'd shouted. "This is all different than what we learned last year, and besides, it doesn't make any sense the way they want us to carry things, and she makes us show all our work, and there's not even enough space on the page." "What about using another piece of paper?" I said quietly. "We're not allowed, Mom," he screamed, and tears were beginning to run down his face. "You don't understand. We're not allowed. We have to do it on this sheet or we get points off. This is so stupid." And he pushed over the chair, ran upstairs, slammed his door so hard that I swear I felt an answering vibration in the living room floor, like the aftershock from an earthquake. "You want to talk about things?" I said that night as I sat on the edge of his bed. "Nah," he said. "It might make you feel better." "I feel okay." "You didn't seem okay when you were doing your math homework." "It's really stupid, the way they do it here," he'd said. I watched him walk away in the supermarket, his head still bent over the video game, skirting the carts intuitively, the way I imagine a blind man negotiates his living room. The long bones in his legs had begun to grow so that he had that tinker toy look a boy has as he becomes a young man, sticks and knobs precariously held together. He would be taller than his father, and better looking, too. He had my nose, not the hawk beak that made Bobby look so terrifying sometimes, his black eyes predatory above it. What else was it that boy, Tyrone Biggs, had said from the witness stand? "That cop man, he scared me." "Did he threaten you?" his stupid defense attorney had thundered, breaking the rules, asking a question he didn't know the answer to. "No, man, he just looked at me. Looked at me real cold." The way some mothers look at their kid for birth defects when they're babies, try to suss out signs of stupidity as they learn to walk and talk. So I watched and waited to see that dark, lowering look on my boy's face, the look the sky has before the rain comes down in gray sheets. 3 months I'd watched him for signs of colic, finally relaxed into motherhood when the danger period passed. It'd take longer this time, looking not for gas but for the early signs of rage. It was why I tried to draw